From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Inheritance by Fritz Lieber. This the room? I put down my cardboard suitcase. The landlord nodded. Nothing been changed in it since your uncle died. It was small and dingy, but pretty clean. I took it in. The oak dresser, the cupboard, the bare table, the green-shaded drop light, the easy chair, the kitchen chair, the cast-iron bed. Except the sheets and stuff, the landlord added. They've been washed. He died unexpectedly, didn't he? I said. Yeah, in his sleep. You know, his heart. I nodded vaguely, and on impulse walked over and opened the cupboard door. Two of the shelves were filled with canned stuff and other supplies. There was an old coffee pot and two saucepans and some worn china, covered with a fine network of brownish cracks. Your uncle had cooking privilege, the landlord said. Of course, you can have them too if you want. I went over and looked down three stories at the dirty street. Some boys were pitching pennies. I studied the names of the stores. When I turned around, I thought maybe the landlord would be going, but he was still watching me. The whites of his eyes were discolored. There's 25 cents for the washing I told you about, he said. I dug in my pocket for a quarter. That left me 47 cents. He laboriously wrote me a receipt. There's your key on the table, he said, and one for the outside door. The place is yours for the next 3 months and 2 weeks. He walked out, shutting the door behind him. From below came the rackety surge of a passing streetcar. I dropped into the easy chair. People can inherit some pretty queer things. I had inherited some canned goods and the rent of a room, just because my Uncle David, whom I never remembered seeing, paid for things in advance. The court had been decent about it, especially after my telling them I was broke. The landlord had refused to make a refund, but you could hardly blame him for that. Of course, after hitchhiking all the way to the city, I'd been disappointed to hear there was no real money involved. The pension had stopped with my uncle's death, and funeral expenses had eaten up the rest. Still, I was thankful I had a place to sleep. They said my uncle must have made his will just a little while after I was born. I don't think my father and mother knew about it, or they'd have mentioned it, at least when they died. I never heard much about him except that he was my father's elder brother. I vaguely knew he was a policeman, that was all. You know how it is, families split up, and only the old folks keep touch, and they don't talk to the young folks about it, and pretty soon the whole connection is forgotten, unless something special happens. I guess that sort of thing has been going on since the world began. Forces are at work that break up people and scatter them and make them lonely. You feel it most of all in a big city. They say there's no law against being a failure, but there is, as I've found out. After childhood and easy circumstances, things got harder and harder. The depression, family dying, friends going off, jobs uncertain and difficult to find, delays and uncomfortableness about a government assistance. I tried my hand at bumming around, but found I lacked the right temperament. Even being a tramp or sponger or scavenger takes special ability. Hitchhiking to the city had left me feeling nervous and unwell, and my feet hurt. I'm one of those people who aren't much good at taking it. Sitting there in my dead uncle's worn old easy chair, with the night coming on, I felt the full impact of my loneliness. Through the walls I heard people moving around and talking faintly, but they weren't people I knew or had ever seen. From outside came a mixed-up rumbling and murmuring. Far away I could hear a steam engine grunting heavily. Nearer, the monotonous buzz of a defective neon sign. There was a steady thumping from some machinery I couldn't identify, and I thought I heard the whine of a sewing machine. Lonely, unfriendly sounds, all of them. The dusty square window kept getting darker, but it was more like heavy smoke settling than a regular evening. Some trivial thing was bothering me, something unconnected with the general gloominess. I tried to figure out what it was, and after a while it came to me suddenly. It was very simple. Although I usually slumped to one side when I sit in an easy chair, I was now leaning straight back, because the upholstery was deeply indented toward the center, and that, as I immediately realized, must have been because my uncle had always leaned straight back. The sensation was a little frightening, but I resisted the impulse to jump up. Instead, I found myself wondering what sort of man he'd been and how he'd lived, and I began to picture him moving around and sitting down and sleeping in the bed, and occasionally having some friend from the police force to visit with him. I wondered how he'd pass the time after he was retired. There weren't any books in sight. I didn't notice any ashtrays, and there wasn't a tobacco smell. It had probably been pretty lonely for the old man, without family or anything, and here I was inheriting his loneliness. Then I did get up and started to walk around aimlessly. It struck me that the furniture looked sort of uncomfortable, all stuck back against the walls. So I pulled some of it out. I went over to the dresser. There was a framed picture on it, lying face down. I took it over to the window. Yes, it was my uncle, all right. For David Rode, Lieutenant of Police, retired July 1, 1927, was inscribed on it in small, careful handwriting. He had on his policeman's cap, and his cheeks were thin, and his eyes were more intelligent and penetrating than I'd expected. He didn't look so old. I put it back on the dresser and then changed my mind and propped it up on top of the cupboard. I still felt too nervous and sickish to want anything to eat. I knew he should have gone to bed and tried to get a good rest, but I was on edge after the day at court. I was lonely, yet I didn't want to take a walk or be near people. So I decided to put in some time looking through my inheritance in detail. It was the obvious thing to do, but a sort of embarrassment had been holding me back. Once I started, I became quite curious. I didn't expect to find anything of value. I was mostly interested in learning more about my uncle. I began by taking another look at the cupboard. There was canned stuff and coffee enough for maybe a month. That was fortunate. It would give me time to rest up and hunt for a job. On the bottom shelf were a few old tools, screws, wire, and other junk. When I opened the closet door, I got a momentary shock. Hanging against the wall was a policeman's uniform, with a blue cap on the hook over and two heavy shoes jutting out underneath, and a nightstick hung alongside on a nail. It looked lifelike in the shadows. I realized it was getting dark and switched on the green-shaded drop light. I found a regular suit and an overcoat and some other clothes in the closet. Not many. On the shelf was a box containing a service revolver and a belt with some cartridges stuck in the leather loops. I wonder if I ought to do anything about it. I was puzzled by the uniform, until I realized he must have had two, one for summer, the other for winter. They had buried him in the other. This far, I hadn't found much, so I started on the dresser. The two top drawers contained shirts and handkerchiefs and socks and underwear, all washed and neatly folded, frayed. They were mine now, if they fitted me. I had a right to wear them. It was an unpleasant thought, but practical. The third drawer was filled with newspaper clippings, carefully arranged into separate piles and bundles. I glanced at the top ones. They all seemed to be concerned with police cases, two of them fairly recent. Here I figured was a clue to what my uncle did after his retirement. He kept up an interest in his old job. The bottom drawer contained a heterogeneous assortment of stuff, a pair of spectacles, a curiously short, silver-headed cane, and an empty briefcase, some green ribbon, a toy wooden horse that looked very old, and I wondered idly if he had bought it for me when I was a baby and then forgotten to send it. and other things. Quickly, I shoved in the drawer and walked away. This business wasn't as interesting as I'd expected. I got a picture of things all right, but it made me think of death and feel shivery and lost. Here I was in the midst of a big city, and the only person I felt at all close to was 3 weeks buried. Still, I figured I'd better finish the job, so I pulled out the shallow drawer under the tabletop. I found 2 recent newspapers, a pair of scissors and a pencil, a small bundle of receipts in the landlord's laborious hand, and a detective story from a lending library. It was called The Lodger. Would they want me to pay the rental on it? I guess they would not insist. That was all I could find, and as I thought it over, it seemed very little. Didn't he used to get any letters? The general neatness had led me to expect a couple of boxes of them, carefully tied in packets. And weren't there any photographs or other mementos, or magazines or notebooks? Why, I hadn't even come across the jumble of advertisements and folders and cards and other worthless stuff you find somewhere in almost every home. It suddenly struck me that his last years must have been awfully empty and barren, in spite of the clippings and the detective story. There wasn't any knock, but the door opened and the landlord stepped inside, moving softly in big loose slippers. It startled me and made me a trifle angry, a jumpy sort of anger. "I just wanted to tell you," he said, "that we don't like to have any noise after 11 o'clock. Oh, your uncle used to cook at 8:30 and 5. "Okay, okay," I said quickly, was about to add something sarcastic when a thought struck me. "Did my uncle keep a trunk or box in the basement or anything like that?" I asked. He looked at me stupidly for a moment, then shook his head. "No, everything he had is right here," and he indicated the room with a sidewise movement of his big, thick-fingered hand. "Did he have many visitors?" I asked. I thought the landlord hadn't heard the question, but after a while he came to and shook his head. "Thank you," I said, moving off. "Good night." When I turned back, he was still standing in the doorway, staring sleepily around the room. Again, I noticed how the whites of his eyes were discolored. "Say," he remarked, "I see you moved the furniture back the way your uncle had it." "Yes, it was all up against the walls, and I pulled it out." "You put his picture back on the top of the cupboard?" "That's where it used to be?" I asked. He nodded, looked around again, yawned, and turned to go. "Well," he said, "sleep well." The last 2 words sounded unnatural, as if he dragged out with prodigious effort. He closed the door noiselessly behind him. Immediately, I had snatched the key from the table and was locking it. I wasn't going to stand for him prying around without knocking. Not if I could help it. Again, loneliness closed in on me. So I had arranged the furniture in the old pattern and put the picture back in its proper place, had I? The thought frightened me a little. I wish I didn't have to sleep in that ugly cast-iron bed. But where else could I go with 47 cents and my lack of gumption? I realized suddenly that I was being foolish. It was perfectly natural that I should feel a little uneasy. Anyone would in such queer circumstances. But I mustn't let it get me down. I would have to live in this room for some time. The thing to do was to get used to it. So I got out some of the newspaper clippings that were in the dresser and began to go through them. They covered a period of 20 years or so. The older ones were yellow, and turning them over, looking at the headlines, and here and there reading a little. After a while, I found myself plunged into accounts of a phantom slayer who killed wantonly and for no apparent motive. His crimes were similar to those with which the uncaught Jack the Ripper horrified London in 1888, except that men and children, as well as women, were numbered among his victims. I vaguely remembered hearing about 2 of the cases years ago. There were 7 or 8 altogether. Now I read the details. They were not conducive to pleasant thought. My uncle's name was mentioned among the investigators in some of the earlier cases. That was by far the biggest pile of clippings. All the piles were carefully arranged, but I couldn't find any notes of comments, except a tiny scrap of paper with an address on it, 2318 Roby Street. It puzzled me. Just a solitary address without any explanation. I planned to look it up someday. It was night outside now, and the upward slanting light from the street lamp made it easier to see the dust on the window pane. There weren't any new noises coming through the walls, just a low, sharp drone of some radio voices. I could still hear the buzz of the defective neon sign, and another engine was puffing in the distant yards. To my relief, I found I was getting sleepy. As I undressed and hung my clothes with uncustomary neatness on the kitchen chair, I found myself wondering if my uncle had arranged his in the same way. Coat over the back, trousers over the seat, shoes underneath with the socks tucked inside them, shirt and tie draped on top of the coat. I opened the window 3 inches from the top and bottom, then remembered that I seldom opened my bedroom window from the top, and did some more of the same wondering. I was thankful I still felt sleepy. I pulled back the covers of the bed, switched off the drop light, and jumped in. My first thought was, here his head lay. I wonder if he died in his sleep like they told me, or if he'd wake paralyzed, an old man alone in the dark. That wouldn't do. I told myself and tried to think how tired and tense my muscles were, how good it was to rest my feet and be able to stretch and relax. That helped a little. As my eyes became accustomed to the semi-darkness, I noted the dim outlines of the objects in the room. The chair piled with my clothes, the table, a queer little highlight reflected from my uncle's picture on top of the cupboard. The walls seemed to press in close. Gradually, my imagination went to work picturing the great city beyond the walls, the city I hardly knew. I visualized block after block of dingy buildings, with here and there clusters of higher structures, where the stores and the streetcar lines lay, the great looming masses of warehouses and factories, the dismal expanse of track and cinders in the railroad yards, with the rank and file of empty cars, lightless alleys and the nervous surge of traffic along infrequent boulevards, row after row of ugly two-story frame houses crowded close together, human forms that in my imagination never walked upright, but slunk through the shadows close to the walls. Criminals, murderers. Abruptly, I broke off this train of thought, a little frightened at its vividness. It was almost as if my mind had become outside my body, spying and peering. I tried to laugh at the idea, so obviously a result of my tiredness and tension. No matter how alien the city seemed, I was safe in my little room with the door locked. A policeman's room. David Rode, Lieutenant of Police, retired July 1, 1927. I dozed and fell asleep. My dream was simple, vivid, and singularly realistic. I seemed to be standing in a cobblestone alley. There was an unpainted fence with a board fallen from it, and beyond it the dark brick wall of an apartment building with outjutting back porches, a wooden framework painted gray. It was the hour of dawn, when life is at low ebb and sleep clings everywhere like a chilly mist. Formless clouds hid the sky. I could see a yellow shade flapping out of a window on the first floor, yet I couldn't hear the sound. That was all, but the feeling of cold fear that got hold of me was difficult to describe. I seemed to be looking for something and yet afraid to move. The scene changed, although my emotions remained the same. It was night, and an empty lot, with a great billboard shutting off the harsh light of the street lamp from most of it. Dimly I could see the things in the lot, a pile of bricks and old bottles, some broken barrels and the stripped wreck of 2 automobiles, their fenders rusted and broken. Weeds and rank grass grew in sprawling clumps. Then I noticed there was a narrow, bumpy path crossing the lot, diagonally, and along it a little boy was moving slowly, as if he had come back to look for something he had lost earlier in the evening. The horror brooding over the place was directed at him, and I felt terribly afraid for him. I tried to warn him to shut and tell him to run home, but I could not speak or move. Again the scene changed. Again it was the hour of dawn. I was standing in front of a 2-story stucco house, set back a little from the street. There was a neat lawn and 2 flower beds. A block away, I could see a policeman slowly walking his beat. Then a force seemed to take hold of me and move me toward the house. I saw a cement walk and a coil of hose, and then, in a kind of little nook of recess, a huddled form. The force bent me down toward it, and I saw that it was a young woman, her skull beaten in and her face splotched with blood. I struggled and tried to cry out, and I made a great effort and came awake. For what seemed a long time, I lay tense and afraid to move, feeling my heart pounding. The dim room swam around me and figures moved about, and for a while the window wasn't where it should be. Gradually, I got control of my panic and forced things to return to their normal forms by looking at them closely. Then I sat up, still shivering. It was one of the worst nightmares I could remember having. I reached for a cigarette and lit it shakily and pulled the bedclothes around me. Suddenly, I remembered something. That stucco house. I'd seen it before, very recently, and I thought I knew where. I got out of bed, switched on the light, and rifled through the newspaper clippings. I found the photograph all right. The house was the same as the one in my dream. I read the caption. Where girl victim of phantom slayer was found. So that was what had caused my nightmare. I might have known it. I thought I heard a noise in the hall outside, and I jumped to the door to make sure it was still locked. As I returned to the table, I realized I was trembling. That wouldn't do. I had to conquer that silly fear, that feeling someone was trying to get at me. I sat down and puffed at my cigarette. I looked at the clippings on the table. Did my uncle used to set them out that way, study them, ponder over them? Did he ever wake in the middle of the night and sit up, waiting for sleepiness to return? Abruptly, I got to my feet, swept the clippings into one big pile, and returned them to the dresser. By mistake, I opened the bottom drawer and saw again that queer conglomeration of objects. The spectacles, the silver-headed cane, the empty briefcase, the green ribbon, the toy horse, the tortoise-shell comb, and the rest. As I shut the clippings away, I again thought I heard a faint noise and whirled around quickly. This time, I didn't go to the door, since I could still see my key in it, unmoved. But I couldn't resist the temptation to look inside the closet. There hung the blue uniform, the cap above, the shoes below, the nightstick at one side. David Rode, Lieutenant of Police, retired, July 1, 1927. I shut the door. I knew I had to get hold of myself. I rehearsed in my mind the obvious and logical reasons for my mood and those unnerving dreams. I was tired and unwell. I hadn't had much sleep for 2 nights. I was in a strange city. I was sleeping in the room of an uncle whom I had never seen or remembered seeing anyway, and who had been dead for 3 weeks. I was surrounded by that man's belongings, by the aura of his habits. I had been reading about some particularly gruesome murders. Reasons enough, surely. If only I could get rid of the conviction that someone was trying to get at me. What could anyone want with me? I had no money. I was a stranger. If only I could get rid of the feeling that my dead uncle was trying to tell me something. Make me do something. I stopped pacing up and down. My glance caught the tabletop, worn and covered with scratches, but bright under the drop light. It was not quite bare enough. I hadn't forgotten any of the clippings, but near one corner lay the scrap of paper I had discovered earlier in the evening. I reached for it again and read the penciled address, 2318 Roby Street. I can only explain the strange feeling that gripped me by saying it was as if I had for an instant been plunged back into the atmosphere of my dreams. In dreams, perfectly commonplace objects can be invested with an inexplicably horrible significance. It was that way with a slip of paper. I had no idea what the address meant, yet it stared at me like some sentence of doom, like some secret too terrible for a man to know. With a single quick clutch of my fingers, I crumpled it into a ball, dropped it to the floor and sank down onto the edge of the bed. God help me, I thought, if I went on reacting to things this way. The beginning of insanity must be like that. Presently, my heart stopped pounding, and things got a little clearer in my mind. My senseless terror was subdued, but I realized it might come back at any moment. The thing to do was to get to sleep again before that happened, and take a chance on the dreams. Once again, as I lay in bed, I felt the pressure and the presence of the room. Once again, I saw the whole city around me. I had a sensation of breaking down of walls and of floating over an alien expanse of dingy buildings. It was stronger this time. And then the dream returned. I seemed to be at a meeting of two streets. On my right side loomed tall structures with many windows, none of which showed a light. On my left hand flowed a broad, ugly river, and its oily, slow-moving surface would dimly reflect the street lamps on the opposite side. I could see the outlines of a moored barge. One of the streets followed the river, and a little way beyond, ducked under the approach of a bridge made of great steel girders. It was very dark under the bridge. The other street went off at a right angle. The sidewalk was littered with old newspapers, swirled there by the wind. I could not hear their rustling, nor could I smell the chemical stench. I knew the river must be exuding. A sick horror seemed to hang over the whole scene. A small, elderly man was approaching along the side street. I knew I must cry out to him, warn him, but I was powerless. He was looking around uncertainly, but I could tell that nothing to do with my presence. He was carrying a briefcase, and he tapped the torn newspapers out of his way with a silver-headed cane. As he reached the intersection, another figure stepped out from behind me. It was a dark, indistinct figure. I couldn't make out the face. It seemed to be wrapped in shadows. The elderly man's first look of frightened apprehension turned to one of unmixed relief. He seemed to be asking questions, and the dark figure, was making replies. I could not hear their voices. The dark figure pointed down the street that led under the bridge. The other smiled and nodded. Fright and terror held me in a vice. I exerted all my willpower, but could neither speak nor move closer. Slowly, the two figures began to move along the river's edge, side by side. I was like a man frozen, finally disappeared in the darkness under the bridge. There was a long wait, then the dark figure returned alone. It seemed to me, and moved toward me. Terror gripped me, and I made a violent effort to escape from the spell that held me. Then abruptly I was free. I seemed to shoot upward at a fantastic speed. In an instant, I was so high above the city that I could see the checkerboard of blocks like a map through smoked glass. The river was no more than a leaden streak. Off to one side, I observed tiny chimneys spurting ghostly fire, mills working a night shift. A feeling of terrible and frantic loneliness assailed me. I forgot the scene I just witnessed on the riverbank. My sole desire was to flee from the limitless emptiness in which I was poised, to flee and find a place of refuge. At this point, my dream became both more and less realistic. Less because of my impossible swimming and swooping through space, and my sensation of being disembodied. More realistic because I knew where I was and wanted to get back to my uncle's room, in which my body lay sleeping. Downward, I shot like stone, until I was only 100 feet above the city. Then my motion changed, and I skimmed over what seemed to be miles of rooftops. I noted the soot-covered chimneys and oddly shaped ventilators, the ragged tar paper, the rain-streaked corrugated iron. Larger buildings, offices, and factories loomed up ahead like cliffs. I plunged straight through them without retardation, glimpsing flashes of metal and machinery, corridors and partitions. At one time I seemed to be racing a streetcar and beating it. At another I hurtled across several brightly lighted streets, in which many people and automobiles were moving. Finally my speed began to lessen and I swerved. A dark wall came into view, moved closer, engulfed me, and I was inside my uncle's room. The most terrible phase of a nightmare is often that in which the dreamer believes himself to be in the very room in which he is sleeping. He recognizes each object, but it is subtly distorted. Hideous shapes peer from dark corners. If he then chances to waken, the dream room is for a time superimposed on the real room. That was the way with me then, except the dream refused to come to an end. I seemed to be hovering near the ceiling, looking down. Most of the objects were as I had last seen them. The table, the cupboard, the dresser, the chairs. But both doors, the one of the closet and the one to the hall, were ajar. And my body was not in the bed. I could see the crumpled sheets, the indented pillow, the blankets flung back. Yet my body was not in the bed. Immediately my feelings of terror and loneliness rose to a new pitch. I knew that something was dreadfully wrong. I knew that I must find myself quickly. As I hovered, I became aware of an insistent tugging, like the pull a magnetic field exerts on a piece of iron. Instinctively, I gave way to it and was immediately drawn out through the wall into the night. Again, I sped across the darkened city, and now the strangest thoughts were whirling through my mind. They were not dream thoughts, but waking thoughts. Horrible suspicions and accusations, wild trains of deductive reasoning. But my emotions were dream emotions, helpless panic and mounting fear. The housetops over which I skimmed became dingier, grimier, and more decrepit. Two-story houses gave way to huddles of sagging shacks. Coal dust choked the clumps of sickly grass. What ground showed was bare, heaped with refuse. My speed lessened, and simultaneously my fear mounted. I noted a dirty sign. Roby Street, it read. I noted a number. I was in the 2300 block. 2318 Roby Street. It was a ramshackle cottage, but neater than its neighbors. I turned off back off the house where the muddy alley was and the dim shapes of packing cases. There was a light in the back of the house. The door opened and a little girl stepped out, carrying a small tin pail with a cover on it. She wore a short dress and her legs were thin and her hair was straight and smoky yellow. She turned back for a moment in the doorway and I heard a coarse female voice say, "Now mind you get over there fast. Your pa likes to have his food hot. Don't stop on the way and don't let nobody see you." I could hear again. The little girl nodded meekly and started toward the dark alley. Then I saw the other figure, the one crouching in the shadows at a spot she must pass. At first, I saw only a dark form. Then I came nearer. I saw the face. It was my own face. I hope to God no one sees me as I look then. The indolent mouth twisted into something between a grin and a snarl. Nostrils flared, the nondescript eyes bulging from their sockets so that the white showed all around the pupils, more animal than human. The little girl was coming nearer. Waves of blackness seemed to oppose me, driving me back, but with one last effort, I threw myself at the distorted face I recognized as my own. There was a supreme moment of pain and terror, and then I realized I was looking down at the little girl, and she was looking up at me. She was saying, "My, but you scared me. I didn't know who you were at first." I was in my own body, and I knew I wasn't dreaming. Ill-fitting clothes cramped my waist and shoulders, pulled at my wrists. I looked down at the lead-weighted nightstick I held in my hand. I reached up and felt for the stiff visored cap on my head, then downward, where in the dim light I could see that I was wearing the dark blue uniform of a policeman. I do not know what my reaction would have been if I hadn't realized that the little girl was still staring at me, puzzled, half smiling, but frightened. I forced my lips to smile. I said, "It's all right, little girl. I'm sorry I scared you. Where does your pa work? I'll see that you get there safely, and I'll bring you home again." And I did that. My emotions were exhausted, paralyzed, for the next few hours. By questioning the little cautiously, I found out the way to the section of the city in which my uncle's rooming house was situated. Afterwards, I managed to return there undetected and strip off the uniform, hang it in the closet. Next morning, I went to the police. I told them nothing of my dreams, my uncanny experience. I only said that the queer assortment of objects in the bottom dresser drawer, in conjunction with the things mentioned in the clippings, had awakened certain ghastly suspicions in my mind. They were obviously and unpleasantly skeptical, but consented to a routine investigation, which had startling and conclusive results. Most of the objects in the bottom drawer, the silver-headed cane, and the rest were identified as having been in the personal possession of the victim of the Phantom Slayer, and as having disappeared at the time of the murders. For example, the cane and briefcase had been carried by an old man found dead under a viaduct near the river. The toy horse had belonged to a boy murdered in an empty lot. The tortoiseshell comb was similar to one missing from the battered head of a woman whose dead body was found in a residential district. The green ribbon had come from another battered head. A close examination of my uncle's assignments and beats completed the evidence by showing that in almost every case he had been patrolling or stationed near the scene of the murder. There had been at least 8 murders all told. They had begun while my uncle was still on the force and continued after his retirement. But apparently, he had always worn his uniform to lull his victim's suspicions. The collection of newspaper clippings was attributed to his vanity. The incriminating objects he had kept were explained as symbols of his crime, ghastly mementos. Fetishes, one man called them. There is no need to describe the degree to which my nerves were shaken by this confirmation of my dreams and my sleepwalking experience. Most of all, I was terrified by the notion that some murderous taint in the blood of our family had been communicated to me as well as my uncle. A considerable time afterward, I related the whole matter in strict confidence to a doctor whom I trust. He did not question my sanity, as I feared he might. He took my story at face value, but he attributed it to the working of my unconscious mind. He said that during my perusal of the clippings, my unconscious mind had realized that my uncle was a murderer, but that my conscious mind had refused to accept the idea. This resulted in a kind of mental turmoil, magnified by my distraught and highly suggestible state. The will to murder in my own mind was wakened. The slip of paper with the address written on it somehow focused that force. In my sleep, I'd got up, dressed myself in my uncle's uniform, and walked to the address. While I was sleepwalking, my mind imagined was on all sorts of wild journeys through space and into the past. The doctor has told me of some very remarkable actions performed by other sleepwalkers, and as he says, I have no way of proving my uncle was really planning to commit that last murder. I hope his explanation is correct.